In a few moments, we're going to be looking at the parable of the minas. It's a little weird to me in Luke 19 that we still don't have a good word in English to translate this Greek word mina, so we still just call it the parable of the minas. And before I come to that, but you can be turning there to Luke 19, before I come to that, I want to give you two things by way of background that I think will help you understand this parable when we read it. So there's one that's kind of a far context, and there's one that's a nearer context, and I want to give both of them to you. So in the far context, we actually need to learn about this Roman ruler, a man by the name of Archelaus. Okay, so about 30 years before Jesus read this particular parable or spoke this particular parable, Herod the Great, who was the king, who was the emperor, who was the Caesar over this entire Roman Empire, he passed away. And he entrusted his kingdom then to his children and kind of this hodgepodge of people, and they divided his kingdom into a tetrarchy, which is four. So each one didn't have the full power, but they had like a fourth of the power. And one of these guys, Archelaus, his son, was the tetrarch over this region of Samaria and Judea, where this story and much of the ministry of Jesus' life takes place. Now, I'm telling you this story because there comes a point where Archelaus has just basically inherited a portion of the kingdom, and he's named some kind of quasi-ruler over that. And in order to prove himself to Caesar Augustus, who is the big Caesar now, he decides that because of this little insurrection that's going on in the temple at the Passover, he's going to flex his muscles, he's going to send an army, he's going to wipe out a bunch of Jews who are worshiping in the temple at Passover, and he's going to be like, see, I'm awesome, I'm powerful, I got control. And Caesar is supposed to see that and be like, oh yeah, man, you're awesome, like, king. And so that's what he does. And Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that this Archelaus guy has 3,000 Jews slaughtered in the temple at Passover because he didn't like the kinds of things. They were causing a disturbance. They weren't all in on his leadership. They were frustrated by the kind of leader that he was. So he murders them. And then he runs off to Rome, and he appears before the Caesar, and he says, do I get my kingdom or not? And interesting enough, there's a delegation of 50 Jews and Samaritans that went together. These people that hated each other apparently found a common enough enemy in Archelaus. They go together to Rome, 50 people, and they stand there prepared to tell Augustus all these reasons why you should not make Archelaus king over us. And some different testimonies exchanged, but Augustus says, you know, I don't even need to hear from these guys. So he doesn't hear anything from the delegation, and he decides at the end of that time, I'm not going to make you king, but I'm going to give you more power than what you had. So the Jews in Jericho are all very familiar with this, we're going up now to Passover, and they still remember, it's just one generation old, this slaughter of Archelaus. There is his palace, there is his castle that he has built for himself in Jericho. So even as we're going to find Jesus is passing through Jericho on the way to Jerusalem, they're probably seeing that's his residence that he has spent, you know, the equivalent of millions and millions of public dollars to build for himself. That's one thing. Then the near context is this, and I'll go ahead and call you to look at the first verse that we're going to read this morning, verse 11. Because this context is important as well. It says, as they heard these things, so it's referring to the previous story, as they heard these things, he, Jesus, proceeded to tell them a parable, notice, because he was near to Jerusalem and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So here's the picture of this context. I mean, because usually we're not told, Jesus told this parable because. But he's telling you, the context of these particular parables or this particular story is very important. So Jesus is going up to Jerusalem at Passover, and it says all these Jews suppose, oh man, this is the Messiah. You know, he's healing everybody and he's showing us the power of God, so this is the Messiah. And he's going to go to Passover and he's going to somehow flex his might and overthrow Rome, and we're going to see the full manifestation of his power and his authority and his glory, and it's going to be right now, and that's what they all expect. Which is why the very next story after this is the triumphal entry, which some of you are familiar with, Palm Sunday, of everyone saying, you know, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, and we're making you king today. And they had something in mind when they were saying, we make you king over us. They had that full, final kingdom of God where they came out on top. And they're free from Rome and all of that. So let's, with that context of Archelaus and Jesus going and having very different ideas in mind of why he's going to Jerusalem and what kind of king he's going to be, let's read this story then. So verse 11, as they heard these things, he proceeded to tell them a parable because he was near to Jerusalem and because they supposed the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit, and you reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank? And at my coming, I might have collected it with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. And they said to him, but Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. This is the word of the Lord. Now again, looking at the context and now knowing the story, you realize that Jesus is presenting himself as this nobleman. He's the nobleman of the parable. And he's saying, I'm coming to Jerusalem not to flex my muscles and to lay down a kingdom and lay down my authority and power in the way that you think I'm going to. In fact, it's going to look radically different than what even his own disciples thought it was going to look like. But he's saying, I'm this nobleman and I'm going to go away. And then there's going to be this ellipsis of time, and then I'm going to return. And the big question that this parable answers is, what are we supposed to do in the meantime? And I love this because, you know, just preaching through the Gospel of Luke, we come to a text that is incredibly relevant to our lives. We don't have to do anything with it. It's answering a question that we, in a sense, all have, even if we don't realize we're asking it. Like, okay, I got this life. What am I supposed to be doing? And Jesus looks at, with this parable, he looks at one big, massive thing. And this first point I call the responsibility of the king. And I don't mean that this is the king's responsibility for himself. I mean, it's the king's responsibility for you, for me, for everyone who would say, I follow this king. So notice verse 13. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. Basically, he's just saying, I'm going to give you something, and you do business with that. It's literally, you be occupied with this until I come. Now, I'll tell you something that I had a little bit of an epiphany this week that helped me understand this text. Many of you are probably familiar with the parable of the talents. It's often called that, and we even have a word today. We think of like, oh, a talent is not just, and primarily to us, it's not a coin. You know, in this culture, a talent was a coin. It's a large sum of money. But today we think of a talent as like an ability, a special ability. Like I can do something that a lot of other people can't do. I have this talent. Well, it comes from this parable of the talents that's in Matthew 25. And I'll tell you, like up until this week, I kind of read those as just, he's just saying the same thing two slightly different ways. But my epiphany of that what really helped me understand this particular parable was realizing these are two entirely different parables. They have a lot of similarities, but Jesus is making two very different points. And I'll tell you what he's making in the point he's making in that other parable first, because this may help some of you that have done the same thing that I did and thinking they're the same parable. In the parable of the talents, you may remember he goes to different servants. He says, to you I give five talents, to you I give two talents, to you I give one talent. So to different servants, he's giving different amounts. And it says based on their ability. So that too is a picture of Jesus saying, I've given you more ability than I've given you. Your call until I come is to not worry about what she's doing with her five. It's to worry about what you do with your two, because I've given you that ability. And we know in the real world, like some of us just have, they're high capacity people, right? And you look at them and you're like, how does that person like pastor a church, write books, do conferences, you know, how do they do all the things? And then blog every day. How do they do that? You know, and then there are medium capacity and lower capacity people. And our human tendency is to compare and contrast ourselves, and we want to look as busy as that high capacity person. See, I'm important too. And in that parable, Jesus is like, don't worry about that. You worry about the capacity I've given you. You worry about the specific gifts and abilities and opportunities I've given to you, because the gifts and abilities and opportunities are different for every person. And you don't have to worry about what that other person's doing. You worry about what you're doing. And I used to kind of import that idea into this parable, and I struggled to make sense of it. So this week as I read and reread and kind of pored over this, I realized this is very different, because here in this parable, you've got 10 servants, and the master says, one for you, 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 times 10. So it's very different than saying you're high capacity, you're lower capacity, just worry about your opportunity. He's saying, I don't care how much ability you have or how high or low your capacity is, you still get one. You get exactly one. Your lower capacity, you still get exactly one. And so you think across the spectrum of people with different gifts, different abilities, different opportunities, what is this one that Jesus is giving to every single one of you? What is this deposit? And I realized later that the Apostle Paul, actually, who wrote most of the New Testament, he picks up on this idea that there's a deposit entrusted in every single one of you. And it's the same deposit. And you know what you know how the Apostle Paul read this? Do you know what he thinks the deposit is? It's the gospel itself. That this is not so much about what ability do I have? What's my spiritual gift? I got to figure out my spiritual gift so I know how to serve God in the church. It's you've been entrusted with the gospel, and you've been entrusted with the gospel, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you. All of you have been entrusted with the gospel. And now I'm going away. Here's your responsibility. Put the gospel to work right here, right now. Because every single one of you, you're going to have different ways that you do that. You're going to have different opportunities. You're going to have different capacities. But you have the gospel, and you've been entrusted to do something with it. And you notice how vague the king's command is. Engage in business until I come. Because the king knows, based on your different personalities, based on your different education levels, based on your different social networks, based on your different interests, you're going to do different things, putting that mina, that gospel, to work. But your responsibility is to put it to work. And I think hopefully that helps you now understand the rest of this parable. Going on from the responsibility of the king, we see in this parable of Jesus, there are three responses to the king, three different ways that as people look at the king, they react one of these three ways. Number one, and I'll just get this out of the way, there is the rejection response. Okay, we see here in this text, Jesus is basically forecasting the fact there are going to be many, many people who despise me for no cause. And you think about that. You know, Jesus is going through the world. He's always saying the right thing, the loving thing, the great thing. There's no better way to say anything Jesus said. He's healing the sick. He's casting out demons. He's forgiving the worst of people, like we just saw with Zacchaeus last week. And people are still hating him. Hating a guy who only ever did good and spoke good. Hating him. And it's interesting that as we hear in our world today, the stated reasons for rejecting Christ, the stated reasons for rejecting God are many, but it really comes down to one underlying reason. Verse 14, what's the underlying reason why people reject Jesus? The citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, "We do not want this man to reign over us." And that's the bottom line still today in our culture. As you see people, maybe even family members and friends, rejecting Jesus, they may give you a number of different superficial reasons, but the reason beneath all reasons is that people don't want God to rule over them. We want autonomy. I mean, instinctively, we want to think, I'm a free person. I do what I want. I don't have to serve this king or this god. I don't have to make someone else the Lord of my life. And what we ultimately want is this sense, at least, of independence. We want a sense, at least, of I'm in control of my life. And that leads to rejection of God oftentimes because God, Jesus, is saying, well, you're going to have to surrender that control and trust me that when I'm in control of your life, I mean, not only are you saved eternally, but things are going to go much better for you in this life. So rejection. Then the next one we run into, just reading chronologically through the text, is what I'm going to call faithfulness. And I call it faithfulness because I think the king is much less concerned about, okay, but what exact return did you get? So it's not productivity so much as it is faithfulness. Notice verse 16, where the first of the positive servants comes back to Jesus, comes back to this nobleman and says, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And then the next guy, verse 18, comes and says, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And notice the response of the king is not like, oh, what a bummer. I mean, I wish you could have done like the guy that had 10. I mean, the first guy is like, 10, wow, that's fantastic. Next guy, I only had half of what he had. I had 5. And the king is like, wow, that's great. That's fantastic. Because the king knows you've been faithful with the gospel within the context of your personality, your ability, your opportunities. And for some, 5 is going to be faithfulness. For some, 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 is going to be faithfulness. And again, we get ourselves off track and we start comparing, well, what are the results of my life? What am I seeing as the result of me sharing my faith? I give up. Because these other people do it, and it's just like, I mean, they could say anything, and people are like crying and repenting of their sin, and I share and share and share and share, and nothing happens. Well, what God is calling us to in this text is faithfulness. And I want to use a different important word, and that is the word stewardship. That I want you to see here in this text, the servants intuitively understand that what I'm working with is, in a sense, not my own. It's the king's. You notice that each of them says, verse 16, verse 18, they don't say, Lord, I went out and I took what was mine and I did the best with it and I leveraged this and I. They, both of them said, Lord, your mina, your coin. And by the way, if it's helpful at this point, a mina was equivalent to 100 days' wages. Okay, so I'm just dramatically rounding. So some of you make more than this, some of you make less than this, but just assume that you make, your gross income is $5,000 a month. This is basically 3 months' salary. So Jesus is saying, here's $15,000 for you, 15 for you, 15 for you, 15 for you. Now go and be faithful with it. And they recognize this principle of stewardship is this $15,000 isn't my $15,000. It is the master's $15,000 that I get an opportunity to do something with. I get to go invest it. Okay, so there's that principle of stewardship. I want you to notice something else, that within that stewardship, the servants also recognize somehow the thing I've been entrusted with has inherent power. Because, I mean, this is kind of a weird way to put it. Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. It's not, I took your mina and I made 10 minas more. It's literally attributing the action of the verb to the coin. They're saying, I've been entrusted with something that has its own inherent power. And when I went out and I started investing it, it just did this kind of on its own. Again, giving us hints that it's the gospel that it's talking about. That the gospel, you know, Romans 1, it has that inherent power from God to transform lives. Now, I want to talk about this faithfulness word for just a moment. I think sometimes in Christian circles, it's very easy. I mean, Andrew and others can attest to this. You go to pastors' conferences, and everybody wants to know, like, what are the numbers, right? You know, how fast is your growth track? What are the numbers? And the numbers they're talking about are like bodies in pews or chairs and dollars. And there's this reaction to that of like, ew, I'm not going to measure my success the way the world measures success. I'm just going to be faithful to God. And you heard that. Like, I'll just be faithful. And that's great. That's great. Great. Just be faithful. But I think sometimes, honestly, just being faithful can be a bit of an excuse for stubbornness. Just bullheadedness. And I'll give you an illustration. Let's change the illustration to something else that Jesus used as an illustration of the gospel, and that is seed. And Jesus says, the gospel is like seed that you sow. You're responsible to go out and partner with me in ministry, and you have to sow the gospel. Like, someone has to speak it. Someone has to get it out there, broadcast it, right, into the soil. So what would you think of a farmer that has two fields, and this one field is, like, pretty rocky and a little distance from water. And then this other field, there's a fence, and right next to it, there's this lush, fertile field with, like, there's a pond and there's a stream flowing through it. And year after year, he keeps sowing into this rocky field and sowing and sowing and sowing. And he's being like, well, you know, I work my tail off every day, and I don't get much of a crop out of this field, but, you know, bless God, I'm faithful to sow. And he'd be like, well, why don't you be faithful to sow in that field? You know, take your livestock from there, put them over here, because they don't mind the rocks. They'll find a place to lie down. And so right there, where you got the creek, and you can irrigate, and it's lush, fertile soil. Like, maybe you should be faithful there. You control inputs, not outputs. You control what you do with what God has given you. You don't control what happens with it. Okay, and I want to set everybody free that, you know, if you're sitting there, like, looking at the outputs, there's only this many people and this amount of money, and we wish more people were getting saved, but we feel guilty, we feel bad, versus, like, oh, we feel really proud because all those numbers are growing and massive. Well, you didn't control that. You controlled the key behaviors that you put into the investment of the gospel, and instead of just stubbornly being like, well, I'm just going to keep sowing in that field, well, why don't you switch? Instead of just being faithful, why don't you be faithful to the few key things that have the greatest potential of bearing fruit for the kingdom? See, I think God is calling us in this text as we look at, well, there was a guy with 10 and there was a guy with 5 and this other guy did nothing with it. We'll talk about him in a moment. We need to be faithful making the kinds of investments that are most likely to bear fruit for God. You know, my wife is in commercial real estate, always meeting with brokers, always looking at different properties. And one of the things that she does is she's running projections on a property before she considers offering on it. And if she's looking at a particular property and running projections, and like, oh, if I need to put this much money into it, and these are the rents, and this is what I could probably bump the rents to after completely renovating, and these are the people I need to take care of on that property, so it looks like this. This other property, oh, it's going to make like 10 times the money of this property, and the investment in both is about the same. Well, what property do you think she would invest in? And Jesus, I think one of the reasons he puts this in business terms is because sometimes that's easier for us to understand. When we demystify the spiritual experience, what would you do in the business world if you were trying to figure out where to invest $15,000 or $15 million? You would do a little due diligence. Where am I going to get the best ROI? Where's the return on my investment? I'm going to invest there. Well, let's do that with the gospel. That's what faithfulness looks like. So that's the rejection response and the faithfulness response. But you see one more guy here, And I call this the idleness response, where he essentially decides, I'm not going to do anything with the gospel. And commentators go back and forth, like, was this guy saved? Was he a Christian? Or was he unsaved? This is talking about a Christian. This is talking about a follower of Jesus. But he has been entrusted with this gospel, and he's been given opportunities, and he decides, oh no, I don't know what to do with this. I don't really know what my Lord is like, and so here, I'm going to stick it in a handkerchief and tuck it in my pocket, and I'm not going to lose this, and I'll be able to give it back to him when he comes. And you notice that it's, as bad as that is, that it's just an idle response, just a lazy response, a careless response. But you notice it gets worse, because when the master comes back and says, really? You stuck it in a handkerchief? He's like, well, yeah, because I knew you're a severe man. I know that you take things that don't belong to you, and you control these. And what he's doing is, it's not enough that he was idle with the gospel that he had been given, but he's actually turning and blaming God. He's turning and blaming the nobleman, the master. And he's saying, it's really actually your fault, because you take what you don't deposit, you reap what you don't sow. I mean, the reality is, this is slander. This is not the way the master is. If when I read that the first time, you're like, what? Is Jesus saying that he's severe and that he does these things? No, he's not. The point is, the servant has no idea who his master is. Or if he does know, he's willing to lie to himself to justify his laziness. And I think it's still somewhat the same today, where I believe that having a heart to share the gospel with other people, having a heart to invest the gospel in other lives, it doesn't begin with simply going out and doing it, usually. But if you get a compelling picture of who Jesus actually is and what he's actually done for you, if you really know the master that you have opportunity to serve and how he set you free and how he's called you into partnership, this instinctively flows from you, and your return may be 2-on-1. It may be 3-on-1, 5-on-1, 10-on-1, 100-on-1. I don't know, but you will go and invest. And the reason this guy doesn't, it looks like he doesn't know God's nature. Now let's go to this final point, the recompense of the king. Now, I use the word recompense because a recompense can be a reward, it can be a punishment, it can be like, I'm just giving you what you're due. That's a recompense. I'm going to flip the order a little bit so I can end on a positive note. The worst part of this is, we started out with these enemies who say the king cannot rule over us, and we see right in this text, Jesus' own words, he says, okay, my enemies will be destroyed. It's just that simple. Those who refuse to recognize the authority and the glory and the kingship of Jesus, they will not continue to live joyfully under his rule forever. They won't. I mean, it's right there in the text. And again, what could be more fair? If someone's sitting there their whole life saying, I refuse, I don't want that king, I don't want that, like Archelaus, he's miserable, he's despicable, he uses his power to ruin us. Okay, well, go live somewhere else where you don't have to submit to Archelaus' authority. Great, okay. You don't want to submit to the king of the universe, the one who made you, the one who gave his life on a cross to redeem you. Well, God's not going to force you to, but he gives you the ruin that you choose out of his presence. That's the bad part. Now, let's deal with this idle guy, the guy who didn't do anything with his mina except stick it in a handkerchief. And I'll put it like this. I think this is the idea. The idle are shamed. Because you notice that in front of these servants, the master condemns him for slothfulness, number one. You were lazy. You were foolish. You did nothing with the gift that I entrusted to you. But you notice that he goes one step further. It's not just his slothfulness that he's being shamed for, it's also his hypocrisy. Because the king basically says to him, if you really thought I was that way, I mean, I know you're just justifying yourself. I know you're just making an excuse by saying, wow, the reason I didn't do this is because the king is like this. And he's like, okay, great. If you thought I was actually like that, then at the very least, you would have gone to the, and it's literally, you would have gone to the exchange table and you would have turned it in, so that someone can go and work with the $15,000 for the next however many months or years, and at least I would have gotten interest off someone else being willing to invest it, but you didn't even do that. And so this guy ends up losing his stewardship over that. The one is taken from him and given it to the one with 10. Everybody's like, wait, but he already has 10. And he's like, Yeah, because to those who have much, by their investment, I will give more, because they've proven themselves trustworthy. To those who do nothing with what I've given them, why would I give them more? I'll take what you're unwilling to use for my kingdom, and I'll give it to someone who's willing to use it. And that's the idea of shame. And by the way, if that point leaves you feeling a little bit guilty, if you're sitting there like, well, what have I done with the gospel that's been entrusted to me? You know, if Jesus returned right now and was like, okay, turn in your mina and tell me how many you've made, what would I tell him? Okay, and you're supposed to be thinking this way. I'm not saying it's bad to ask the question. But if that leaves you feeling guilty, like, oh, I haven't been doing a good job investing that. I'm kind of like this guy that I have the gospel, and it's deposited deep down in my heart, and I love Jesus, and I go to church, and I read my Bible, but how am I investing that? How am I putting it to work to bring other people into the kingdom with me? I'm not doing that. I feel really bad. Well, okay, feel really bad for 2 seconds. Guilt in the Christian life is intended to drive you to Jesus for forgiveness, and he forgives you. And I want you to see something else important, that when the king returns, in a sense, it doesn't matter what you did with the mina. You still get entrance into the kingdom by grace alone. So the king is not saying, I rule you out because you horrible person. Like, you said you trusted in me, and I believed you, and I gave you that deposit, and you didn't do anything with it, so forget it. No, you got to understand, the love of Jesus Christ is unconditional. And he's welcoming even that servant home. I printed 1 Corinthians, these verses that we're going to use as a handle for our repentance in just a few moments. I printed this in your bulletin for you so you can see. I think it's a similar idea where Paul is talking about how this foundation has been laid. He's using a different metaphor, but he's using the metaphor of building. He's saying the foundation has already been laid. The foundation is Jesus Christ. You can't lay another foundation for your life. If you're going to build a successful life, you can't build it on anything other than Jesus, and you can't build it on Jesus plus. Because if you have one foot on Jesus and one foot on the plus will collapse and you will fall. So just build your life on Jesus. That's what Paul's saying. He's saying, but as each person chooses to build, you can build with non-perishable materials, like gold and silver and precious metals, or you can build with wood, hay, and straw. And when I come back and I test your work, Paul's saying there in 1 Corinthians 3, when I test your work, some of you, like the entirety of your work is just going to be burned up. But you will be saved. Okay, feel guilty, repent, say, God, what do you want me to do with the deposit you've entrusted to me? Because I can do better, but rejoice in the fact that he says, but you will be saved. Because I think for most of us, it's not just like we're entirely building out of wood, hay, and straw, and we're not entirely building out of really awesome stuff that's going to live forever. For most of us, it's some kind of mix, right? 80-20, 70-30, 50-50, I mean, I don't know, but it's some kind of mix. And if we see that the idol, if we just do nothing, or we just foolishly go on building our lives the way everyone's building their lives, that's burned up, then that pushes us toward this third response, or this third recompense, which is that the faithful are rewarded with both praise and partnership. Notice verses 17 and 19, that when the nobleman, when Jesus comes back, he says to the 5 and to the 10, well done. Good job. Do I care that it was 5 instead of 10? I don't care. You did a good job with the opportunities and the abilities and the gifts and the relationships that I blessed you with. Great job. That's the praise part. Hearing your master say, well done. Good job. Way to go. The partnership part is this. You notice that the king doesn't say, okay, great job. Now here's a monetary reward. The reward is, interestingly enough, it is more responsibility. It's like, okay, I gave you responsibility with the gospel. You did something with it. Now here's more responsibility. So I want you to notice 2 things about this reward. Number one, the reward correlates with the fruit. It does. Because he says to the one, okay, you made 10, so I'm giving you 10 cities. You made 5. I'm giving you 5 cities. You did nothing. You lose yours. Okay? So there's a correlation. between what you did with what God gave you and the responsibility that you ultimately end up with, okay? So understand, you all get to heaven by God's grace working through faith in Jesus Christ alone. But do not take that to a cheap grace where you say, okay, so then it doesn't matter how I live until he returns. It absolutely matters how you live until he returns. Because in a sense, you're standing in heaven, your recompense in heaven, like there still is this reward. I mean, Paul talks about like these five crowns of faithful Christians. I don't know exactly what those are. I mean, I know how he describes them, but it's like there's something beyond just, okay, whew, I got into heaven by the skin of my teeth. Now praise Jesus forever. Well, you will. And some of you, you will. Maybe literally, in a sense, get in by the skin of your teeth. Because you didn't do anything to bring anybody with you. You didn't do anything to invest the stewardship of the gospel. But you got in. So that's the first thing here, is the reward correlates to your fruitfulness, what you did with what you were given. But I want you to also notice that the reward is wildly disproportionate to any of our effort. This, again, is an evidence of the grace of Jesus Christ. Okay, so again, the picture is, let's just take the guy who had 10 at the end. Okay, so Jesus says, here's $15,000. Again, I'm just trying to put it in today's terms. Here's $15,000. I'm going away. The master comes back. Okay, what do you have to show for yourself? And he says, well, master, I took your 15 and I made 150 more. 150,000 more. Okay, 1,000% return. Most of you would be pretty happy with 1,000% return on anything. Okay? So he says, here's 1,000% return. Here's $150,000. The master's like, good job. You get 10 cities. Okay, here's Denver. Here's Boston. You get New York. I mean, 10 cities for $150,000? That's absurd. But this is the grace of Jesus. He says, I see your faithfulness toward fruitfulness. And my recompense is like crazy generous. And this is God too. That his reward is crazy generous. Yes, it has something to do. There is a correlation with what you do with your life, but it's crazy generous. Okay, so I want to just close with this. Let's think about what are some ways to be a good steward of the gospel. And to simplify this for everyone, in your gospel community questions, which even if you're not in a gospel community, take those application questions and look at them. And I want you to just think in business terms, in money terms, because that's the illustration Jesus uses. Like, if I had $1 million to invest, what are some principles or what are some things that I might do to decide to invest that $1 million here instead of here so that I get a better return? You know, all of you would do some research. You would, because you want a better return. Okay, and don't raise your hands, but how many of you are, in a sense, researching when and where and how you share the gospel? Like, I've only got so many hours in my day. Where would I go? What kind of conversations would I have that are most likely to bear fruit with this gospel? See, we would do the research with the money, but there are probably very few of us who do the research with something that's far more valuable than money, the gospel itself. But it's okay to do that kind of research. It's okay to ask yourself questions and think, one way to steward the gospel would be in my family. What am I doing with opportunities, even within my own family, with a spouse or a sibling? My kids, if you know many of you have children. You know, my parents need the gospel right now. My aunt and uncle need the gospel right now. My cousins need the gospel. Like, how does my family, how am I taking this good news, this hope of Jesus, and investing it into the different relationships I already have so that I get a return on it for Jesus? And we expand that out to vocation. And, you know, many of you are like, oh, this vocation, it's just like this chunk of 40 or 50 or 60 hours of my week that has nothing to do with my Christianity. But it can. I mean, it should. It ought to. Come and let's talk about that, because whatever your vocation is, there are ways to think through, how could I invest all these hours and hours and hours, you know, teaching classes or facilitating this or putting out reports or, you know, carpentry or, I mean, whatever you guys do. What are ways to leverage that vocation so that I'm investing in a kingdom return? How am I doing this in my neighborhood? How am I doing this in my free time? And these are questions we need to ask and answer. And I even encourage you in the notes this week, as you start landing on different ways to invest the gospel, share it. Share your ideas. Share them on social media. Like, hey, I never thought about this, but if I would do this with money, this is something I could do with the gospel. Many of us act as if the gospel is meant to be stored. Sweet, I got this deposit. Now let's turn this into Fort Knox so no one steals my deposit. I've got my deposit. I can safely go to heaven when I die. And I want you to understand, if you change just a couple letters, that deposit is not designed to be stored. That deposit is designed by Jesus Christ to be shared. Let's have conversations about this. I don't even want to tell you specifically how you need to share it or invest it. I think, again, some of you are going to invest it, and it's going to be a 2 out of 1, a 3 out of 1, a 5, a 10, a 20. And what God calls each of you to is, Jesus, you're coming soon, or I'm going to go to meet the King. In the meantime, let's be faithful to be fruitful.